The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Jordan Calhoun, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today we're tackling the tricky issue of navigating your finances and your career in 2021.
Yeah, and for many of us, our career goals were thrown off course during the pandemic that started in 2020. But fortunately, here to help us with that is personal finance expert and friend of The Upgrade, Ramit Sethi.
The challenge I would give to people is to execute the 10-second resume test. Close your eyes, look at your resume for 10 seconds, and then put it away and answer this question: who is this person? So if your resume doesn't say exactly who you are and what you've accomplished, that's an opportunity for you.
Ramit is the New York Times bestselling author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich. We had him on The Upgrade back in 2019 for an episode called How to Get Rich, as well as in May of 2020 for an episode on how to protect your money.
Ramit's been writing about personal finance for over 17 years now, and his company, IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com, educates more than 1 million users every month.
So Jordan, are you a person who's comfortable with money topics?
I am extremely comfortable with money topics. Actually, one of the things that sort of frustrates me about our culture surrounding money is just how non-transparent it is, and how in the U.S., like, it's taboo to talk about your finances and how much money you make and anything sort of related to how you receive and spend money. And what happens as a result is just a lot of people, I feel, suffer in silence. One of the things that I find most interesting, I think a lot of readers find most interesting, if ever you're reading like sort of these voyeuristic pieces on how people spend their money, is just like, ooh, I finally get some insight into a real person. And you find out that like other people have credit card debt, or other people have student loan debt, or other people spend money on this. We're just so thirsty for that information. Yeah. Of like, there's certain secrets, like how people spend money, how much they earn, how they look for a job, what someone's like interview, like there's so much around jobs and finance that are sort of structurally secret. And some employers, I don't even know if this is legal or not, but some employers either like strongly recommend, or if it's illegal, like just the culture is one that you don't talk about how much money you make. Yeah. And that's always been sort of strange and frustrating to me. I don't know. How do you feel?
It's really true. We're so in the dark about what people are supposed to be making or what people are making in certain industries. And I've found it at separate times, like looking for new jobs or looking even for how much should I get for a raise, trying to go even online. And there are all
mystery.
These calculators, and they're just clearly wrong.
So
you're like, well, none of these are helpful in any way.
So where do you
have to like ask people you know, and then that somehow is like needlessly awkward. I feel like it shouldn't be.
Right,
it should be
right.
A really easy question to ask.
And who loses in that is all of us. Like basically when we're trying to negotiate for a raise, or we're trying to look for a job and we're trying to negotiate our salary, you're negotiating from a place of ignorance, which sucks. And that just makes it harder for everyone. And I guess large corporations win, I guess is the moral of that anecdote.
Yeah. And I think especially now during the pandemic, a lot of people looking just feel like I should just take whatever they give me, because things are dire, and you know, I should be lucky I could get a job.
Right. People are completely in the dark, and I expect our guest Ramit will be able to help sort of clarify a lot of that darkness and get some advice on how people can better look for a job this coming year.
All right, let's find out.
Let's do it.
Welcome to The Upgrade.
Thanks again. Great to be here once again. I love coming on the show.
It's time number three. We were just saying you're our first three-timer.
Yeah, I'm very flattered to hear that.
So glad to have you.
So the last time we had you on, it was in May. And it was the beginning, what we thought was sort of, I don't know, mid-pandemic. Did we know? Did we have any sense of where we were? But I don't think we realized we'd be this far in and still at home. And you painted a fairly bleak picture of where we could end up and told us kind of bend down the hatches, you know, trim your investments. There's another term for that I'm not getting right. But like, you know, basically like don't invest too much in your 401ks, make your cash liquid, basically prepare for the worst. How have your predictions played out, and where are we now in that? Where is your head?
Well, I remember very vividly speaking with you last time. And one of the things that I talked about was panic is bad, but overreaction is good. And I had traditionally recommended people target a 6-month emergency fund, but because of the uncertainty, I was recommending a 1-year emergency fund. And again, doesn't mean you have to be able to accumulate that overnight, but it means that because some entire industries are being decimated, I want to make sure you have some liquid cash in case the worst happens. Well, 6 or so months later, you know, in many segments of the economy, people have increased their savings and their savings rate hugely. So you have many people who are sitting on larger amounts of liquid cash than they've ever had before. But you also have certain segments that their jobs are gone and they've been at home. They haven't been given any support or minimal support. And so they're really struggling. My advice in terms of panic is bad, but overreaction is good, I think that advice stands. I will say that there are certain industries where we have seen that demand has remained high. For example, if you're a software engineer and you decided to move from a certain city to a different city, you may not need to plan for the absolute worst in your industry. You may be able to say, hey, from looking around, there's still a very tight labor market for my job. And you know what? I'm going to be satisfied with 6 months. But that's up to you and your judgment. In general, I would say I still recommend overreacting in times of crisis. And that's exactly what I've done. And for the people who did that, I think they're very thankful.
What about for those people who lost their jobs and lost their source of income, their primary source, and they're looking for a new job now in these new times? What advice might you give that would be different than pre-pandemic times? Or is it more or less the same? Are people's solutions to job searching now just to cast a wider net since there's probably going to be more job seekers out there? What's changed for job seekers now than pre-pandemic?
Well, the big change is that a lot of people have gotten a taste of what it's like to work from home and they don't want to go back. They
want that hour and a half
commute every day. No way, no how. They like it or they want flexibility. Hey, I actually do want to go back into an office, but I don't want to go 5 days a week. I want to go 3 days a week. So there's a huge groundswell to know how to find remote jobs. And I let's talk about that absolutely today, because there are certain ways of interviewing on Zoom. There are ways of finding jobs that offer you remote work or even convincing companies that traditionally haven't done it. Hey, you're based in DC, I'm based in Chicago or Austin, Texas, I can still be an amazing contributor to your team. So we can talk about that. That's what's changed, but some advice does not change. And I love timeless advice. I love it. I wrote my book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, because I wanted it to be timeless. And so if you go and read the first edition from 2009, most of that stuff, 99% of the investment advice is the same. That's as it should be. For careers, what most people do when they're looking for a new job, something causes them to be unhappy at work. Let's say that they're a marketing manager. So they get really frustrated. They go, oh, all right, I'm sick of this. So they go home. The first thing they do is they update their resume, right? That's what they think the first thing they need to do is they update it. And you know what they put on their resume? Some chronology, some boring chronology. First I did this, then I did that. Nobody cares. Then they go to some job search website. They type in the same job title they have today, the one that makes them unhappy, thinking that somehow magically the grass is going to be greener at another company with the same job title. And then they upload their resume and wait. Guys, this is the most passive way to find a job on earth. That didn't work before pandemic and it won't work after. It'll actually work less because everyone else is doing the same terrible thing. So there's a much better approach. We talk about that in our dream job material to find not just a job, but a dream job.
So what is that approach?
Yeah, you got to tell the people now. You can't just leave us on a cliffhanger.
Don't hold out on us.
First off, we got to stop delegating our job search to algorithms and recruiters. In what other part of life would you do that? If you want a job where you're working 8+ hours a day, you want to enjoy it, you want to be challenged, we need to acknowledge that we are going to take an active role. That's number one. Number two, I want everyone to answer this question, which is, what career season are you in? Let me quickly walk you through this. Most career advice gives you the same advice, whether you want to downshift to spend more time with your family, or whether you want to get a $350,000 a year executive job at a tech company. How can that be? Those two are, they're different animals. They're in a different universe. So we identified three career seasons. The first is, this is when I was in my 20s. I was willing to work 60 hours a week, Saturdays, Sundays, no problem. I was in the growth season. Okay. I want to grow. I want to grow my career, my income, my exposure. At a certain point, some of us switch to lifestyle. Maybe I want to take care of kids or elderly parents, or I just want to go skiing more. That's lifestyle. And finally, we've all heard stories about the lawyer who decided, I want to become a beekeeper. That's reinvention. So in order to find the dream job, you need to first really look inside and acknowledge, which one are you? Just like the seasons on Earth, there are career seasons and they come and go. If you are in growth season, then you're going to search for jobs where they promote, where they pay top of market, and where they're actually going to say, yeah, we work a lot. You may work weekends. But if you're in lifestyle, you can automatically cross those off because you're looking for more things like work-life balance. So you can see how when most people go to a job search site, they're literally just typing in words and letting an algorithm control it. But the real dream job search starts from within. Who am I? What do I want? And you have to choose one. Everybody tries to straddle the fence and, oh, well, I'm lifestyle, but I'm also growth. No, pick one. And then we can go deeper.
And I think the way you're saying it is, it's not just like your growth, then lifestyle, then whatever the other one is. The autumn of your lives.
Yeah.
Like it goes around and around.
Reinvention. The
midlife crisis stage.
And after midlife crisis, you just sail off into the sunset. No, it's not that. We have seasons, and some people are growth for their entire life, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Some people decide after lifestyle, they're like, you know what? Okay, I raise my children. I want to go back into growth. There's no judgment placed. As I always say, your rich life is yours. So when I talk about money, if somebody wants to, like I had a computer, same computer for 8 years. Doesn't matter to me. I don't care. I ran my entire business off it. If somebody wants to spend that money instead on a certain type of food they love or a beautiful trip or coat, be my guest. That's your rich life. Same thing with your career. Your dream job is yours. The job that I have and the jobs that I've had would make no sense to other people, but we have to first look inside. Okay, so that's part one. Then we want to go a little bit deeper. When we get really specific about our job title and our company, suddenly we can narrow the focus down. So when I ask people, what do you want to do in your career? A lot of times they give me these similar answers. I want to help people. I'm like, okay, I want to breathe oxygen. Well, can we get a little bit more specific than that? I like to work around smart people. Okay, good, et cetera. What I am looking for after they go through a process, I want them to be able to say something like this. Well, I'm in the growth season of my career. I'm looking for a marketing manager or senior marketing manager role at a tech company that allows remote work and does B2C marketing. Now that is specific. Okay, and we could even get more specific. What that allows you to do once you've gotten that crystal clear is you can start finding those companies and circling around them, almost like a shark. Okay, what's my vector? How am I gonna get in? How am I gonna meet people who work or have worked at the company and get introductions in? Because I don't wanna go through the front door. Totally different approach than, hey, I'm just gonna update my resume, fix the margins and upload it and wait.
Oh man, I feel like a powder keg right now. I have so many questions that, okay. So Ramit, I love this stuff. And one of the things that I feel is missing from these type of conversations when it comes to careers and things, finding the dream job, I feel that's an understandable and amazing and appreciated focus for most people who are, searching for happiness, whatever that means, or searching for some type of contentment in their career. But I think what's often missing from these conversations is the reality of desperation. And I think sometimes people are not necessarily looking for their dream job, but they're looking to make ends meet and they need a job that just meets a minimum decent standard of living. Is there advice for people on if they're looking for that, you know, minimum decent standard of living, how they should be approaching a job search right now. And also, I think that that's okay for a short term. I think a lot of the focus always jumps over that stage of like, you know, making ends meet, getting your finances in order, and then finding a dream job, where I think it's I've had a small number of jobs that were dream jobs, that are jobs that I absolutely love, that I feel great and fulfilled in. This is one of them. I love my job right now. I love working with Alice. I love Lifehacker. I've also had plenty of jobs that were placeholder jobs that I didn't love the job, but it was appropriate for that season of my life. And I don't think it was in either of the three categories that you described. I wasn't planning on growing there because I honestly didn't give a fuck about it. I wasn't like reinventing myself. I wasn't doing any of those three categories necessarily, but I was basically treading water to get the energy to swim. And I would love to hear advice for those people who are more or less desperate right now or in a financially challenging position so that they can tread water until they can swim. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think there's a wide swath of people who are not thinking about a dream job, but rather a job. And, you know, for that group, first thing is just to simply be able to breathe a little bit and to be able to get out from underwater and to say, okay, I need a stable job that's going to provide for me and provide for my family. And that dream job stuff is nice, but I need a job right now. So for them, you can apply some of the same principles I talked about, but you don't have to go the full way. For example, when we're talking about a dream job, you know, there's a very systematic process to go build your network, to find people who have worked at the company, do informational interviews, and how to update your resume in a way that actually sails past everybody else. Well, candidly, you're probably not going to go out for 10 informational interviews if you're already working, you know, 15 hours a day. What you can do, though, is you can focus on what you can control. So there are lots and lots of things that are within your control. Number one is your, what we call your marketing material, your resume and your cover letter. Now, I've seen literally thousands of resumes as a hiring manager, and I've also applied to many companies and gotten roles at companies. Your resume is something that's totally within your control. Most people, when they put their resume, it has no narrative. It's just, here are some facts of what I did. The challenge I would give to people is to execute the 10-second resume test. Close your eyes, look at your resume for 10 seconds, and then put it away and answer this question, who is this person? So if your resume doesn't say exactly who you are and what you've accomplished, that's an opportunity for you. Okay. Second thing is your cover letter. It's not just an opportunity to regurgitate what's on your resume. It's actually an opportunity to convince the hiring manager why they should bring you in for an interview. And it's always good to start with, I'm very excited to apply for XYZ company. Here's why. No generic cover letters ever. And finally, a follow-up. You do those things, you've already dramatically increased your chances of getting an interview. Okay. And then finally, if you want to know what to do once you get in for the interview, because there's a lot of people who can get an interview, but they get stuck there. And that can be very frustrating. Well, an interview is a skill, just like riding a bike. You're going to get predictable questions. You need to have answers ready for them. Here are some of the questions you're going to get. Why do you want to work here? Why did you apply here? Tell me about yourself. Tell me about your last role. And finally, do you have any questions for me? You need to have perfect answers to those because you're going to get them. So if you do this level of basic preparation, this is some basic stuff, but it will set you apart from everyone else. And even if you're working 12-hour days right now and you're just looking for a placeholder job, those techniques are going to help you land a job, which is going to let you breathe.
I have to say, as somebody who does a lot of hiring, I could not agree with your points more. And one thing that always strikes me is the lack of individualized cover letters. I mean, cover letters to me are everything. They're so much more important than the resume. Most people I've hired, they came in for an interview solely because I was so impressed by their cover letters that often I wanted to tell them, like, well, after I hired them, like, your cover letter was like, I've saved them. I have like a whole, like, you know, just an honor list of like these great cover letters I have. And then on the other side, there's people who, number one, always start their cover letters with, my name is X. Like, I know your name. It's signed. You just signed it. You don't have to say, my name is Alice Bradley and I'm applying. I know you're applying and I know your name. And just keep it. And they just keep it so, so generic. And people don't have questions for you. These two things are like the kiss of death. If you don't have a question for me, why are you here? I don't understand.
So I'll tell you that, you know, I share in your frustration, but I also have a lot of compassion for the people who are applying.
I'm just kidding.
Because this stuff.
Alice is savage. Alice is.
I think that really nobody teaches us this. And I want to tell you a little story about why I got interested in this. Because my pet hobby in college was interviewing at different companies. And I love interviewing, right? I get to dress up. I get to talk about myself for 45 minutes and tell a couple jokes. And then I find out whether basically they liked me or not. It's very binary. So I found it to be a puzzle. And I found a few friends who are equally weird. And we would compare notes about our interviewing. What'd they ask you? What'd you say? Ooh, that's a good answer. And we started to get very good at interviewing. But what we realized was that nobody teaches us this. Nobody, not at the best schools, not at typical colleges, nowhere. And in fact, the advice you get, if you go on Google, how to get a job, it's the worst advice possible. The first thing they tell you is the 1.25 inch margins on your resume. Nobody cares. They tell you, they give you generic cover letter advice. And you know what? I have a philosophy, study the winners. I don't want a free Google resume. That's worthless. So what we did was we've helped thousands and thousands of people get dream jobs. So we brought them in and we said, give us your resume that landed you a six-figure job. Give us your cover letters. Show us the things you brought into your interview that got you $10,000 to $80,000 raises. Those are the people you want to study because you can see that they're operating at a completely different level than the free advice you get on Google. And that is why when people go out and they search resume example, it's sort of, I mean, yes, it's frustrating as a hiring manager, but I also have a lot of compassion because the advice they're getting is just junk.
Yeah.
That's why we created this. That's why I want to show people, even if people are listening and some of them are a little intimidated or some of them are like, hey, I'm just looking for a job. Guess what? You still deserve great advice. You shouldn't be given the worst advice just because you're looking for a placeholder job. You should be shown what everyone else has shown, what I learned at Stanford and what I learned to land jobs at Google and all these other places. I believe everyone should have access to this advice or at least know that it exists.
Yeah.
Alice, well, do you remember?
Like a huge, huge bitch. But anyway, sorry.
Alice, do you remember my cover letter? Because now I'm wondering if I said my name is Jordan.
Name is Jordan. No, you had a very good cover letter. I mean, if somebody could say it and then be hilarious, and I would overlook them, you know, not that you have to be like a comedian. You know what I mean? I'm just going to backtrack completely. I understand everyone's plight. They're all hired.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
You know, when you're thinking about Ramit, when you're talking about those people who studying the winners, you know, those people who got these huge raises and sort of, you know, had huge success, I imagine to some degree by asking for it or demanding it. I'm also thinking about, again, going back to people who are just looking for a job, who might have that advice, but might feel uncomfortable with pushing for asking for more. So imagine, you know, you are desperate for this job and you go through this interview process, you're jumping through these hoops, you're finally getting an offer. How might people, any advice for people for salary negotiations right now? You know, let's say someone is actually desperate for a job and they're willing to take whatever. Part of negotiation is like negotiating from a place of non-desperation and strength. But like, what if that's not your reality? How do you go about, you know, asking for more when you really don't yeah, you're very willing to accept less.
Also, just to piggyback off on that, I think there's a lot of companies that now are kind of giving people the, like, you know, we're in a pandemic, like, line in terms of negotiations.
Absolutely.
So what's the pushback for that? And is there one?
There is. This is a great question. And, you know, we've talked a lot about salary negotiation, and I'm well known for teaching people how to negotiate their salaries, whether it is someone who's making $15 an hour and negotiates to $17, or people who are making $120,000 and I show them how to negotiate to $175,000. I've done the range and I have extensive videos and all this stuff on it. I want to point out a couple of things. First off, for the last 12 years, people have been saying to me, well, how can you negotiate in this economy? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How can you negotiate now? Hey, guess what? The economy's been great. The economy's been bad. Those same people keep asking the same question. And maybe it's not about the economy. Maybe it's actually about them simply not having the skills of knowing how to negotiate. So that's one point. You're always going to have people saying that. And they say the same thing to me about personal finance. Ramit, how can you talk about investing? Oh, in times like this. If you'd followed my advice in 2009 when my book came out, you would have made hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I simply do not allow people who use external events only to control what they do. With that said, we do need to acknowledge that market demands change. And if you're going into a salary negotiation, you need to be honest, whether it's an employee's or an employer's market. Okay. Just like rent changes depending on whether it's a tenant's market or landlord's market. If, for example, I'm going to give a hyperbolic one here, you're a software engineer, there's not that many of them, you're in high demand, even with a pandemic, then you can go in and negotiate fully. And you can use our dream job techniques. We show you exactly what to say. And if they say something like, you know, it's a pandemic, we don't really have to, there's a very structured formula that we have to respond to that. And you could say something like this. You could say, you know what? I agree. This is a big investment. But from what I understand from the market data that I've presented here, the range for my experience is between X and Y. And based on my experience, it looks like I'm closer to the top end of that range. So I'm confident we can come to an agreement, but it does need to be within that range. Okay. That's if you have high power. If on the other hand, you don't, then you can ask, but you probably can't push that hard because the employer has 50 other people behind you. Now, everybody listening, I just want you to just note one thing. There are ways to find out if it's an employer or an employee's market. Most people don't ask. So if you're going to walk in and disqualify yourself, then you're doing the wrong thing. At least make the ask, learn the skills, which is what we teach. And if they say no, let them tell you no, but never disqualify yourself. Don't do somebody else's job for them.
Yeah. I think people are so afraid they're, you know, the employer is going to get mad at them as if
like withdraw the offer. Yeah.
Just be like, you know what? Never mind.
Right. Yeah. So I'll tell you, you know, I have a lot of experience because this, we've had a dream job program out since 2012, and now we're relaunching the entire dream job program. So we've helped thousands and thousands of people. In all that time, I've heard of two examples of people having their offers rescinded. Two. It is extremely rare, and it really is a signal of a immature hiring manager because hiring managers are well-versed in this. This is business. It's not personal. And even if it was personal, think about what you're communicating. You think you're communicating, I'm scared. Do you think maybe you could give me a raise? What you're really communicating is I'm valuable. You would be lucky to have me. And I'm interested in this job. And I think we could be a great partnership together. That is high competence. So you need to really flip the way you pursue these jobs. If you're pursuing it out of fear, of course, you're going to get screwed. But you need to learn the skills of top performers, study the winners, and that's how you get jobs for winners.
Education is pretty countercyclical, it tends to be, with the economy. So whenever the economy is in the toilet, a lot of people are considering going back to school and sort of skilling up and finding new skills before they go searching for a new job. What are your feels right now for those people who are considering, you know, going to a trade school or going to a coding boot camp or going to back to get their master's degree or going back to school for some reason to build their skills before going back into the economy. Do you think that's something that's generally recommended right now for people who are looking to get a job? Like, should they prioritize getting a new skill, or does that, is that dependent on sort of what season they are in their lives? What are your thoughts on that?
First of all, I'm a big supporter of education. So I had a fantastic education, undergrad and graduate degrees, and I'm a big, big fan of formal education. I say that because it's become very popular to, demonize and even mock higher education. And I disagree. I think it's fantastic. However, if people are struggling to find a job, it's often a seemingly safe decision to go back to school. But you find that people who do that almost never calculate out the cost of their education and the potential ROI. I would much rather, if they want a job, learn the skills of finding that job. Use our thing, get a career coach, go talk to 10 people. The costs of these are all either free or very nominal compared to dropping $100K on an unproven degree where your only goal is to find a job. If you want to go back because you love learning, if you want to go back because you have an extreme clear line of sight on how this MBA is going to propel you into the next level of management, fantastic. I'm all for it. That education can be a fantastic investment, and I don't just mean financial. But if you are simply, I don't like what I'm doing, I think I'll go back and get this arbitrary degree because a few of my friends got it, and I haven't actually spoken to even 10 people who graduated with that degree, then I would argue against it. If you want to find a job, learn the skills of finding a job.
Ramit, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
So great having you.
Thanks for having me back. Thank you.
Time for Upgrade of the Week, where we talk about that one thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Ramit, what's your upgrade this week?
My upgrade, as we think about starting a new year, is once a year, I like to mentally clear my calendar out and just ask myself, what would my perfect calendar look like this year? And I find that it's way easier to just mentally clear the whole thing and start rebuilding it from scratch rather than trying to take away certain things, because over time it just gets cluttered up with obligations. And so I love this. It gives me a fresh start. It lets me really align my values with my time. And I can add in certain things. Like, for example, this year, I want to take more walks. I'm living in a place where the weather's great. And so, okay, great. I go speak to my coworkers. I say, hey, we usually do this on Zoom. Would you mind if we do this on a phone call so I can walk while we're talking? And quality of life just goes way up. So I'm loving it. And I hope that this is helpful for people as they think about a fresh start.
Yeah, it's like Marie Kondoing your calendar.
There you go.
I love that. And now I'm thinking about like all the meetings I could convert to walking meetings because, you know, with video meetings, you spend so much time just, you know, just sitting here, staring at each other.
Alice, what's your upgrade this week?
So I have really been missing during the pandemic my fancy morning coffees. And, you know, like you can do the regular brewed coffee, but like, where's your cappuccino? Where's your latte? Where's your cortado? I don't know what the other kinds are. So I asked for and received a milk frother for Christmas. It is a $12 gadget. It's not the kind that steams. It just goes in your milk, but you microwave the milk for 20 seconds. You froth it for 10 seconds. It's very frothy. You add the coffee sinks to the bottom. It's like instant cappuccino. Maybe it's not espresso, sure, but it's delightful. And it works really, really well. It makes me really happy every single morning.
Are they that cheap? For some reason, I would have thought that this would be a machine that costs more. I would expect to spend $50.
I think if you get one that's like a steamer that really like shoots steam into the milk, that's going to be a big production. This is like a little, it looks like a whisk. It's like a little whisk. It's battery operated. It's, I think it was $12 or $13. It comes with a little stand. And I think with that, it was $20.
Nice.
So it's kind of amazing. I'm really a big fan.
I love these small, inexpensive gadgets that make you happy every day.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Jordan, what's your upgrade?
So mine is unrelated to money at all. Let me ask you guys, do either of you subscribe to physical magazines still? Do you have any subscriptions?
Oh, I thought you meant like physical health magazines, like...
No, no.
Like men's health.
Gun magazines. There's a lot of type of magazines
Guns and ammo.
That I could have been asking about. But do you have any magazines that you subscribe to?
Yes.
Okay. So if...
Wait, really?
Yeah. The New Yorker.
Oh, man. I have many.
Oh, the New Yorker.
Okay. I have New York Magazine. Okay. New Yorker, which just piles up day after day. Like, one of my favorite jokes from The Good Place is like, hell is being in a room with a pile of New Yorker magazines, and they just keep piling up. And you know you're never going to read them, but they just keep coming. So I have several magazine subscriptions, and they do pile up very, very quickly. And what goes on in the back of my mind is, I'll get to it eventually. Like, I don't want to recycle it yet. I'm going to read them. And then this pile ends up as tall as I am. So my upgrade is a new rule that I've implemented this year, which is a 48-hour rule for my magazines. When my magazines come in, I have 2 days to read them. If I'm not going to read them in 2 days, then recycle it because I'm not going to get to it. And then by the end of the year, I'll have a good idea of like, how much did I actually read Runner's World this year? And if I didn't actually read that many, if it didn't make my 48-hour rule that much, then do I really need to keep this subscription because I'm just like wasting it? So a 48-hour rule is good, I think, for someone like me who ends up, I mean, listeners won't be able to see this, but like, this is just a pile of magazines like on my table. And this is only half of them. And I haven't read a single one of them, but they keep piling up. So I'm going to toss the ones that are old. And of the new ones that come in, I got 2 days to read them or they got to get tossed.
I love that.
Great.
I love that.
Yeah, great technique. It's actually freeing because you're creating discipline in your life, but it frees you to know.
So freeing.
No matter how many come in, I can process.
Absolutely. That's what I'm looking for.
I love, love, love magazines. Just have it. They're like, it's like getting a gift, but then I look at them and I'm like, these are so pretty.
I had like Vanity Fair for a while, Runner's World, New York Magazine, Variety, New Yorker, Wired. I have so many magazine subscriptions and poets and writers, but what use is the subscription if you're not actually going to read them? And I have to be realistic with myself. So that's the new rule this year, 2021. I got 48 hours to read it, or they got to go.
I love it. It's a life hack.
Mm-hmm.
For me, thanks again. This has been great.
Thanks.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Thanks for everyone who submitted reviews on Apple Podcasts and wherever you listen. We really appreciate those. If you would like to drop a review, do it on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you download and listen to your podcast. We'd love to see them. You can also reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving us a voicemail, or you can email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter @Lifehacker, on Instagram @Lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook @Facebook.com/Lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks @Lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade @Lifehacker.com/the show. Jordan, I have a question for you. Hey, Jordan. Jordan? Hey, Jordan.
I'm here. I'm here for you.
I have a question for you. Very natural. Sorry.